and welcome back to Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. I'm Monica Jock, your host, a scientist, and a scientific writer at the life science business of Merck, KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany. In this podcast, I'm speaking with experts about something that seems so simple, yet is actually quite complex, especially for scientists. You guessed it, lab water. Last week, we covered some do's and don'ts when working with purified water in the lab. But have you ever considered all the places where highly purified water is needed? I assure you, some of these locations are quite unexpected. Today, we take a closer look at just two of those places, as me and my guests go on a deep dive through the cultured meat industry and art museums. To kickstart this episode, Water Is It Good For?, I'm joined by my first guest, Bob Ventura. Bob is an applications specialist for MilliporeSigma, which is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany. He's based in Southern California and has been working with our portfolio of MilliQ lab water solutions for over 32 years. Bob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for asking.
Let's start with getting set up. Could you tell me how you help scientists choose their water solution, the one that's right for them?
Yeah. So for me, the best way for me to help my customer choose their water solution is to really understand their needs. First thing I need to know is their application for purified water.
And their application, you made their actual analysis?
Yeah. So are they doing cell culture? Are they doing analytical analysis? Are they doing sequencing?
That must change everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it just helps me identify what purification technologies to put together for them.
Gotcha.
So then I need to know roughly how much water they're going to be using per day. You know, will they be using a couple mLs next to the water system, or will they be using hundreds of liters some distance from the water system and have multiple points of use?
That makes for a totally different setup, I bet.
Yeah. So the systems go from just really a benchtop system, multiple technologies put together for a big water system for those type of large applications. So the next thing I need to know is what level of organics, inorganics, particles, and bacteria would they like to achieve? Are they trying
to achieve?
Yeah, or not achieve. Well, no, we typically achieve
in this case.
Them, right? Are they trying to meet an internal specification or an industrial standard such as ASTM, US Pharmacopeia, or CLSI for water quality? So once I have this information, I work together with the customer and together we choose the best solution to meet their needs.
So this sounds like you've seen everything from A to Z. Can you tell me some of the interesting places you've placed water systems? But start with the most typical, then tell me your stranger places.
Yeah, sure. So I really appreciate the work all my customers are doing. The more typical locations are academic institutes, biotech, and pharma companies. And some of the more unusual or atypical places include crime labs for DNA and analytical analysis, research ships or vessels, large theme parks that have aquariums, and labs that are trying to culture meat.
Cultured meat. I like that. This sounds like something I want. Can you tell me more about these labs?
Oh, sure. So actually, I've worked with a cultured fish startup company. They use a bioreactor to grow cells in a very controlled environment. The ultimate goal is to create actual edible fish while avoiding the depletion of fish stock in our seas.
That sounds like a noble cause.
Yeah. So we're all about the sustainability as well. They would like to use a bioreactor to produce the next sushi that will be served at our favorite restaurants.
That also sounds like a noble cause.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I really appreciate the work my customers are doing. So this customer will be making a sustainable food for us. How great is that?
That's pretty great. Can you tell me if you know the size of the bioreactor? I don't think I've ever seen one of these things.
Oh, I don't know what size they're using.
Okay, I'm just guessing. I'm just trying to imagine. I've only cultured in Petri dishes, so I'm just trying to imagine this setup. Okay.
Well, I know it's larger than a Petri dish.
Yeah, I bet. They probably started with a Petri dish. Someone did somewhere.
Probably.
And so where does purified water come into this process to make lab-grown fish? And don't tell me it's for swimming.
Yeah. So they actually are one of those customers that really require larger volumes of ultra-pure water for cell culture.
Okay, I'm going to assume it's a big bioreactor then, but keep going.
Yeah. So the water needs to be super clean because they're making it to make the cultured cell culture media to grow the fish cells in the bioreactor. Super clean means the water needs to be low in all four categories of contaminants, organics, inorganics, particles, and bacteria. So for an example, to control bacteria growth, we've included several UV lamps in their system. Ensuring low bacteria also helps reduce endotoxin contaminants in the water, which emanate from bacteria cell walls. And to further remove any endotoxins that might be present, the water system also includes hollow fiber membranes, which operates on the basis of size exclusion.
Okay, and all of this, Bob, why is it so crucial to avoid endotoxins in the final product?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Endotoxins are known to negatively impact cell growth and cell division process. Since this company is growing cells, they absolutely need endotoxin-free water in order for the cells to be healthy and grow as they would expect them to grow.
All right. Predictability is important in industry. So yeah, you don't want any surprises.
So in general, not just having low endotoxins, but using ultra-pure water with overall low organics, inorganics, particles, and bacteria lets the scientists strongly control the conditions in order to get accurate and reproducible results. This is especially critical as the end product is hopefully destined for human consumption, meaning I'll be eating it.
Me too,
so
I hope.
Everything needs to be strictly controlled.
Okay. I think the next question is when, Bob? I like sushi. When can I buy this product in my local grocery store?
Yeah, so I wish I could tell you it would be tomorrow, but you might have to wait a while for cultured fish. There's some major cost issues that are faced by this industry due to the cost of the growth media, which is the mixing of sugars, proteins, and other nutrients that feed the cells in a bioreactor. And then there's the challenge of scaling up to an industrial scale.
Or to a Monica scale. That could be a challenge too.
I don't know. We'll have to
Monica
have a
Monica and Bob scale.
We'll have to have a contest to see who could eat more hamachi.
Googling hamachi. It's been a while since I had sushi. Bob, thank you for being my guest for this episode. I learned, and I think our listeners too, learned a lot about what might go into the process of culturing meat, culturing fish. I hope they're reassured. I know I look forward to this process coming to market. For our listeners who are interested to learn more about endotoxins, we've put a link in the show notes, so please check it out. And Bob, I hope one day we can meet in person over a nice cultured sushi dinner.
I agree.
You're buying.
Okay.
Okay. Especially if we're competing. As I hinted at the start, one place where water systems can surprisingly be found is in art museums. My next guest, who can tell me, as well as you listeners, exactly how, is Tracy Jolson. She's based in New York City and has been working as a sales specialist for our portfolio of Millicule Lab Water Solutions for the past 2 years. Tracy, how are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I am excited that it's almost the weekend, but very happy to be here discussing a unique application for lab water with you today.
Good, because I want to hear it. Tracy, I understand that you've worked with some of the most renowned museums in New York City to outfit them with state-of-the-art water purification systems. Could you please tell us, why on earth does an art museum need a water system in the first place?
Well, these museums, as many others across the world, have dedicated personnel who need to keep these artifacts and statues looking like they were built yesterday, which is pretty hard to do considering these items could be thousands of years old. These artifacts can travel from one location to another to be on display, and dust particles or layers of film can build up over time as they're out on display. But they can't just take dish soap or cleaning detergents and apply them to these historical items.
Oh no, that would be wrong.
It could totally, yeah, you know, it could just totally deteriorate that material.
And so how do they clean these precious items? I'd be scared to touch them with a toothbrush. So, and I'm sure that would be quite abrasive. So what do they do?
These are trained professionals. So they take these paintings, coins, anything from archaeological sites, and they'll actually be cleaned with deionized water. Deionized water, which is commonly referred to as DI water, is pure, clean water, which has gone through a purification process to remove minerals, particles, any contaminants that could potentially be introduced to these artifacts. It's the least harmful way to clean, restore, and preserve these artifacts. We could also be feeding a water fountain that's on display. By circulating the pure water, which is free of contaminants, minerals, ions, any particles, we can prevent the growth of bacteria in that water and keep that water clean and that fountain looking good as new.
Ah, that is true, because sometimes you see some pretty scuzzy fountains in public, but you would never see that in a museum. So now I know why. That's the trick. Is there anything else they use water for?
Sure. Well, most labs or most museums have a lab inside the museum. Almost all of them will either be making buffer or solutions to run experiments and potentially determine the age of an artifact by running a PCR reaction. It's really interesting to see what goes on behind the scenes of museums that you may visit regularly.
Okay, PCR makes sense, but I want to come back on your other point about cleaning paintings. Now, I would be worried about washing away the Mona Lisa with water. So how are they cleaning paint?
It's true that the thought of cleaning paintings using water without causing any damage defies intuition. One would naturally fear that the water would dissolve and wash away any pigments and other components. But don't worry, these conservators proceed very slowly and do many small tests before deciding how to proceed. Tests may even be performed under a microscope. In fact, the original drawings and prints on paper are often cleaned by being sprayed with or submerged in water to remove the dirt, stains, acids, or any other products you might see on the paintings. As long as the artwork, both the support and media, can withstand prolonged exposure to water, washing work is good for removing imperfections, such as any stains or discoloration.
Okay, I'm still worried about submerging, but I trust you on the rest. And so again, what type of water is specifically used for these types of tasks?
So the tap water from your sink is never used. That contains way too many contaminants. Fine for drinking, but maybe not for cleaning.
Thank you for saying that, because they're not contaminants for drinking necessarily. Go on, but for art.
Yeah, so tap water contains a lot of minerals, ions, some particles, organics, and that's all fine. But for DI water, cleaning these types of artifacts, that chlorine in tap water could oxidize cellulose, or iron and copper compounds may accelerate the deterioration of cellulose for paper stored under humid conditions. So water for washing paper artifacts must be free of those ions, particles, anything like that, like chlorine, ion, copper compounds. So conservators often wash and clean artifacts with DI water, which is very low in these ions. However, in some cases, they could slowly condition the water by adding small amounts of ions until the water matches the object's pH level. The important step ensures that the water won't damage the art. Interestingly, calcium may specifically be added back into the DI water, which helps to avoid shortening the lifetime of paper. And just so you know, the pH of ultra-pure water or pure water is 7, so it could be lower or higher, and that's why we need to factor in the pH level of the artifact to make sure that the level of ions match.
Yes, I'm sure you definitely don't want to give it a shock. Okay, so that makes sense. So especially since you might intuitively expect that the purer the water, the better the washing process, but it's actually far more technical than that, especially when you tell me they have to specifically add the calcium in.
So you said pure, but I just want to make sure everyone's careful here. If all of ions are removed, which is another layer of the purification process, you would have ultra-pure water, or type 1. That could actually be quite corrosive could potentially lead to removing any pigments.
Let's not do that.
Yeah, type 1 water, it has no ions, nothing in that water, so it pulls from anything that it would come in contact with. Really, the safest thing is stainless steel from type 1 water. But that's a whole other conversation. These art curators are carefully regulating the water quality type.
Okay. I am reassured. Okay. And so for anyone who wants to read more about the effects of wash water quality on the aging of artifacts, or especially on paper, we have a great article link in the show notes. So please check that out. So Tracy, you told me that DI water, this low ion water, is the main criteria for curators. But is there anything else they need to be concerned with their water?
Well, they definitely care about avoiding bacteria. So Our systems provide an antibacterial UV lamp in our systems, which the scientists I speak to love that, and they are mercury-free, which is sustainable, and they don't need to worry about disposing of a toxic element, and it's much safer for the environment.
Good. They like that, and I like that. So I'm glad we're moving forward on this topic to make these lamps safer, which is a big deal, I know.
Yeah, mercury is being banned in a lot of states in the U.S.
Exactly. It's coming to Europe here soon, too. So we're moving forward, and museum curators are aware of this, too. So this is great. And so it brings us to the end of our episode now. Tracy, thank you. I know I have, and I think our listeners, too, have learned a lot, especially about the science in an art museum. Who would have thunk it? For all our listeners who want to read more about the exact steps of paper washing, maybe grandma's art in the attic needs a go. We have a few other links in the show notes, so please check that out. And Tracy, the next time I visit my local museum, I'm going to be wondering where they get their water from. Maybe I'll tap someone on the shoulder and start asking some questions.
Hey, it's a great way to get a tour of a museum.
I don't think it'll get me in for free.
Definitely not. But you'll see the private wing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The lab. Are ghost peaks haunting your chromatograms? Perhaps unstable baselines are throwing you off tilt. Did the band in your gel pull a vanishing act, or you can't reproduce another lab's results? Maybe it all comes down to troubled waters. In this segment, we'll troubleshoot some of these frustrating scientific predicaments with the help of our lab water experts. Today, I'm speaking with Marta Inés Carcagero, a scientist and PhD in our research and development department working on Millikew lab water solutions. Hello, Marta. Good to see you. Can you please tell our listeners a bit about yourself?
Hi, Monica. So I'm responsible for the microbiology and biochemistry lab, where we work on assuring bacteria control and that nucleases and proteases levels are low in our water purification systems.
Excellent. And so normally during this troubled water segment, I hear stories from service engineers and technical experts who have helped scientists troubleshoot their water woes. But I understand that in this case, you were the customer who solved your own mystery. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, sure. It was a long time ago during my master thesis back in Portugal. Part of my work involved purifying a protein using exactly the same protocol as my supervisor did when he was doing his PhD in another European lab. At first, we were very frustrated because we followed exactly what he did. Same buffers, same reagents, the methods, everything you could think of. But we could not seem to have the same results. We could purify the protein, but we lost all its activity.
Oh my goodness, that must have been so frustrating.
Yeah, it was a long process of purification. It took take us more than 1 week. And the last step, we would just have to reconstitute the protein in the basic TRIS buffer and then confirm that we purified the protein by a normal SDS page gel and then check activity with dedicated substrate. And this is where our problems start. We were lucky because we had a positive control, so we knew that our reaction conditions were correct, but something was clearly wrong with our protein. After eliminating all other hypotheses such as pH variation and chemicals, we finally thought that maybe it was a quality of water.
What bothered you about the water?
Well, in Portugal, we were lucky because our system was quite new and the quality of the water was constantly monitorized. So we knew, we were confident about the ultra-pure water produced. However, the previous lab, my supervisor, the system was not so young and the water purified was not so controlled. And we know that the local water was very hard, containing a lot of salt. So we began to lack confidence on that water quality. And we start suspecting that it might be releasing some salts, adulterating the ultra-pure water produced.
I can see the light bulb going on over your head. Sorry to interrupt. How did you test your theory of salts?
So to test this, we decided to add more salts to our buffers, such as calcium, magnesium, and manganese. And voila, Suddenly, our problems were solved and we had a beautiful protein to work with.
Champagne. So that must have felt so good to get to the bottom of that mystery. And so the different water qualities led to different experimental conditions.
Yes, exactly. And it made it impossible to reproduce the original experiments. It was a big lesson for us to consider water quality when troubleshooting. We tend to think that pure water from different labs is the same, but in fact, it's not necessarily exact. And in fact, in a lab, we cannot afford to suspect the water quality. That was a big lesson.
Thank you, Marta, for sharing your lesson and your troubled water story with us. Perhaps we have some listeners who are currently struggling to reproduce results from another lab, and perhaps your story serves as a lesson to consider water quality could be a source of experimental variation. Maybe we save them some time. To our listeners, if you have a troubled water story you want to share, feel free to leave your experience in the comments. Well, there you have it. The name of this episode was Water Is It Good For? And I think we found the answer. From food production to art preservation, and I'm pretty sure everything in between, just remember, it's what's inside that counts. And when it comes to preparing cell culture or cleaning art or lab glassware, less is more when it comes to your lab water. And with that, we've reached the end of this episode. Let us know your thoughts in the comments, give this podcast a rating, and share it with whoever you think might be interested. See you again in 2 weeks. Bye, everyone. The life science business of Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany, operates as MilliporeSigma in the US and Canada.